Welcome to Spotcast. This is Season 3, Episode 8, Veritas. And my name is Tim Mitra, and I am in Toronto, Ontario, and joined by Jonathan Kuhlein in Mississauga, Ontario.
Hey, how's it going?
And I have Jaime Lopez Jr. in Seattle, Washington.
How's it going?
It's going pretty good. But, you know, last week I forgot to do the introductions. I don't know if you guys noticed that or not.
Well, we figured we're just, you know, B parts to this whole thing.
People had to guess who we were. So hopefully that wasn't their first episode and they're like, who are these guys?
You can always loop it in, you know, from some others, like literally the previous episode and see if anybody notices.
I had to do that a couple of weeks ago, right? So a couple of weeks ago. All right. Well, anyway, let's dig into some fact check here. So we were talking, at least I was talking, you guys were probably listening, but I was talking last week about the Foundation series and reference to sort of, since we were throwing all the other, you know, sci-fi worlds into under the bus there last week. So
I didn't get that. Could you try again?
Go away, Siri. she gets told to go away a lot. Anyway, so yeah. So what was I saying? Because I said Foundation series. Anyway, or as Jaime would say, Foundation followed by the word series, right? Anyway, getting back to what I was talking about. So I was talking about the Great Library of Trentor, which is Trentor is a central world in the Foundation series. in Asimov's books, because that's where the Great Library was, obviously. And Harry Seldon, who's the main character of the first book, starts working on this new science called psychohistory, where he's able to, like Minority Report, predict the future of civilizations and stuff like that. And the Great Library in Trentor. So Trentor is very similar to Coruscant, which is from the Star Wars universe, right? The central of the galaxy kind of thing. So, mm-hmm. And as we'll find out when the Foundation, followed by the word series, comes out on Apple TV in a little while, I guess, maybe they'll follow that same sort of thread. Who knows? Who knows? By the way, I've been watching Brave New World. Have you guys been watching that?
I have not.
Not so much? Okay.
I forget which service that's on, to be quite honest.
Yeah, it's on television here in Canada. I don't know about you.
Oh, well, in the land of non-socialized sci-fi
It's so good
media.
To be able to lord that over you, Apple card.
Now I got
to
look it up. I'm going to... Okay, cash. Let me see. Before I look it up, I think it is on... Crap. I was going to say HBO, but it could be Hulu. I'm going to go with HBO.
I think it is HBO Max. I see that at the beginning of the thing, I'm pretty sure. They see it on that other show I watched, the Raised by Wolves, right? Although I do watch the other Raised by Wolves too. Anywho, all right, let's get to the headlines. I think we have Jaime up first.
Yeah, there's got a whole bunch of Marvel news here. So Black Widow has been officially delayed to 2021, apparently now opening hypothetically on May 7th, 2021. So set your calendars.
So that's what, 15 months after it was originally supposed to be out? It was supposed to be out in February this year. Or February? May? May. Sorry. My bad. May. That's still a long, huge long break.
Yeah. Well, you know, there was a sort of pandemic kind of thing happening in the meantime, right? So.
Yeah. And honestly, I wouldn't be surprised if it continues to get bumped. If they're not going to make their $1 billion off it, they'll just keep bumping it until they will, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that was the first part of a bunch of dominoes, right, Jaime?
Indeed. Indeed.
Speaking of dominoes.
The greatest segue into the Falcon and the Winter Soldier being delayed until 2021 as well. So this was going to be the Disney Plus show, which...
TV show? Why would they delay that? Oh, I guess maybe there's tie-ins.
That's what probably the speculation
spoilers.
Is.
Yeah, it probably depends on not only, you know, what's going on in movies, but probably also how far exactly did they get before COVID hit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, ideally you would want to be in post-production because, yeah, that was a mad dash, I'm sure, to get everybody set up with VPN networks and et cetera. But that's different than, oh, we literally can't convene to shoot scenes, which is an altogether different problem.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they also bumped the other two Marvel movies that are supposed to be out in the next little while.
Which are?
Eternals is one. What's the other one?
It's Shang-Chi.
Oh, Shang-Chi.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So they've moved all three of those to next year.
Mm-hmm.
So it's May, July, and I think November is what they've got them slated for now. So that's Black Widow, Shang-Chi, and then Eternals. And I'm curious about that one too, because I think, maybe I'm mistaken, but I think Eternals was supposed to come out before Shang-Chi. So I don't know if there isn't a narrative, like a, you know, post-credit scene thread through these episodes of Marveldom, or how they're doing things differently from before. Because before there was sort of a through line through all the first phases that sort of continued an overarching story. I wonder if they're going to tweak things or change things in order to do that now.
The question was Ferris Bueller sort of the first movie to sort of do that post-trailer?
The post-credit scene?
Yeah.
It's the first one I can remember.
Yeah.
It is fairly old. I'm trying to think of other movies that have done epilogues, but not a trailer. Credits have completely gone by, and then you get an altogether different scene. That's a good question. I don't know what has the...
Yeah, I remember...
Who was the director of that? Was that the Breakfast Club guy?
Yeah, John Hughes.
Oh.
I think the James Bond movies in the 1960s always used to wait till the very last thing and it would flash up James Bond will return.
Right.
But there was no live action to it. It was just, but you knew if you waited till the end of the movie, sometimes it would say James Bond will return in ... and it would tell you the name of the next movie, or sometimes it would just say James Bond will return. And so that was a little Easter egg if you were willing to stick around, you know, and that's going back 50 years. But as far as I can recall, the first one was that scene at the end of Ferris Bueller. And of course, a lovely homage at the end of Deadpool, right? At Deadpool, he comes out in the same bathrobe in the same house. And so it's like bang on, except it's got Deadpool's wearing his mask and everything.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, speaking of Deadpool, what's next, Jonathan?
Well, continuing the Marvel and Disney Plus theme, it was a new trailer for WandaVision dropped this week. They still haven't announced exactly when it's coming, but they did put out a trailer that gives a little bit more of a taste of what it is, and what it is freaking weird. I don't know if you guys had a chance to watch this trailer.
Yeah, it's about five Korean singers or something like that.
Not the same thing, but it's very weird. It's it seems like, you know, there's a bit of a sort of, you know, they're trapped in a 1950s sitcom, but then it also looks like it's going through different eras. And you know, obviously Paul Bettany's Vision is seemingly alive, even though he seemingly died.
Is that supposed to be Vision?
Yeah.
Oh, really? Oh, I didn't get. I knew he looked familiar, but that's not. There's a scene where the guy, the robot-y guy, puts on a face and. Is that Paul Bettany sitting in the chair?
Okay.
I just flashed by to watch it really quickly.
Yeah. No, all those scenes are Paul Bettany playing the Vision and then playing himself as a human version of the Vision.
Right.
So I don't know if this is all supposed to be going on inside of Wanda's head. She's had a nervous breakdown or something, which so is...
Do we know who Wanda is, or...
What do you mean?
Do we know in the Marvel universe who she is?
In the Marvel universe... the comic book universe, she is Magneto's daughter.
Oh, okay.
In the comic books, they do that. In the movies, they gave her that different origin because they didn't have the rights to the X-Men at the time. They had that whole, she was created using the power of Loki's staff thing at the beginning of Age of Ultron, the Avengers Age of Ultron. And then she and Quicksilver, her brother Pietro, the guy who runs really fast in that movie, were supposed to have been like spawned by the powers of this, as opposed to just being mutants.
Oh, this is the same. This is the girl character that has the sort of powers to like move things. Is that the one?
Yeah, she's, well, they call them hexes in the comic books. The idea is that her powers basically are almost limitless in their ability to make the improbable happen.
Right. Okay.
So she and like Vision and the Scarlet, which is one of the first Marvel comics that I read back in the, you know, early mid 80s. When I was sort of just starting to get into superhero comics, and have always been a big favorite of mine. So I'm excited that they have made their way into the cinematic universe, and then now that they're getting their own show. At one point in the trailer, you can actually see them wearing variants of the costumes that they wore, I guess, traditionally in the comic books when they were in the old 1960s and 70s Avengers. You know, billowing yellow cape and the Wanda in her bright red sort of scarlet costume with the long gloves and everything. So it'll be interesting to see
between color and black and white in this show.
Yeah, it seems like there's sort of, at one point it seems like they're in a sort of I Love Lucy kind of thing, and at one point it seems like they're in kind of a Brady Bunch homage. So I don't know if they're doing sort of how, you know, this is all sort of how she's working through her grief about Vision. Like, again, they didn't really, the trailer is very abstract. It doesn't really give you any clarity on what's happening, except that, you know, you do see glimpses of, you know, her using her powers, him using his powers, and, you know, it'll be interesting to see how it all ties together, but it's definitely very visually interesting. What would you guys make of it all?
The trailer?
Yeah.
Well, like I said, I just really quickly whipped through it, so.
How about you, Hemi?
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that, like, whatever is happening here, whether she's doing some reality bending thing or this is going on in her head, in either case, it is kind of interesting that it's not a pure fantasy land, because she has like her mother, or possibly mother-in-law, it's unclear to me which, say, like, oh, so when are you all going to have kids, you know, like a very common sort of pressure you would get from family members. So it's not the idyllic sort of thing necessarily. It seems like there's some aspect of something darker, or perhaps just some realism, that there's only so far the fantasy goes, that it's not perfect. It's like, oh, look, I have this, you know, annoying parents or annoying, you know, in-laws who are wondering where we're going to give them grandchildren, sort of thing, which is not necessarily the sort of thing you would imagine as a fantasy.
Yeah.
Which I thought was an interesting take.
Well, and Scarlet Witch has been a fascinating character with some really interesting takes by different creators over the years in the comics. You know, she was very sort of innocent in her way back in the beginning, and then she also sort of goes to this place where she falls in love with Vision, and then at one point in the comic books she and Vision have children through using magic, and so they do actually have children. And then later on Vision is captured and his memory is wiped, and she has a nervous breakdown, and her nervous breakdown actually manifests in her going very dark, or like just sort of, you know, doesn't give a crap about anything and starts taking people out and has a real, like, goes off the deep end. And at one point she's responsible for this huge calamity where she kills some of the Avengers, and she basically alters reality so dramatically it creates a different alternate timeline called House of M, where mutants rule the Earth. So I don't know if they're ready to go to that, although if they built this the right way, you could tell that story and have it be a segue into the X-Men in the Marvel Universe. But I suspect you wouldn't see that on television. I think if they're going to do something that grandiose, it would be more likely building it up in the movie theaters. So I don't know. I don't know if that's where they're going, but there's been a lot of really good stories written about that character, and maybe they're going to chip away at a few of them, the storyline about maybe them having the kids, or them, starting a life together or whatever, as part of these TV shows.
So as a real-time follow-up, I just scanned through the video, and the staircase in the middle, there's a scene in the middle where that looks to me like the Bewitched house.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure about the Brady Bunch house, but the black and white one is the house from the Dick Van Dyke Show.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, with Mary Tyler Moore.
There you go. Yeah, again, it all seems very familiar when you watch it. It does trigger those sort of like nostalgic memories.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, again, it makes you wonder if this is all just sort of, you know, a delusion or an illusion or magic or alternate reality or something else. But again, visually very interesting.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I've only seen the very first part of it. I guess I didn't watch, so I wasn't really paying attention when I saw it the other day. So, and I don't think I had the volume on, so I couldn't really follow it that well.
Yeah.
There you go. All right, what's next?
Cool. Next up, we've got a little bit of, good and bad news out of the Emmy Awards. So, Watchmen. Oh, that
Schitt's Creek won everything?
Well, Schitt's Creek won everything comedy-wise.
It's Canada's own Schitt's Creek, I should point out.
Which I'm a little torn about. On one hand, I'm very happy for the big Canadian show, and very happy for our Canadian brethren and sestren for getting involved in that, but Good Place was in its final season as well, and they got completely shut out, which is kind of a shame. They actually didn't win anything over their run, which is kind of a shame, because I think that show was one of the smarter shows I've seen in a long time, and kind of would have nice if it would have been recognized. But Watchmen won the Emmy Award for Best Limited Series and kind of kicked butt across those categories. It won
who were they up against? And just for context?
That's a good question.
I still have to go back and watch that one, actually.
You're throwing me a curveball here, man. I know it won a total of 11. There you go. I got the list. Hang on.
It won 11 awards?
It won 11 Emmys.
Wow.
Yeah. So, limited series. It beat Little Fires Everywhere, Mrs. America, Unbelievable, and Unorthodox for best limited series. But beyond that, it also won, it won Best Series, but it also won Best Actress for Regina King, Best Actor for Yahya Abdul-Mateen II, Cord Jefferson and Damon Lindelof won for Best Writing in a Limited Series, Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross for Best Music, Gregory Middleton for Best Cinematography, Victoria Thomas and Megan Lewis for Best Casting, and one for Best Sci-Fi and Fantasy Costumes, Sharon Davis Davis and Valerie Zilanka. So yeah, it kind of kicked the butt out of all those categories. And I will say that was one of the best things. I didn't want to like it at all, but it was really amazing. It was really good.
What, the
Watchmen limited series? It was really good.
Okay.
It was really, I highly recommend it. And particularly in light of the kind of year we've had, because it is a real reflection of race in America. It's the first episode starts, and this is, I don't think, a spoiler. It starts with the Oklahoma City massacre of the black community, yes, absolutely. So a very visceral depiction of that incident, and it's called Watchmen. And it's set in that world, but it's set 30 years after the events of the graphic novel, or so it carries that world forward from that point, but it's not really rooted in, it doesn't change the story of Watchmen. It doesn't change the context. So as I'm not a big fan of people doing things against the wishes of the creators, as they did with this. Alan Moore sort of said it was meant to be a comic, was only ever meant to be a comic, and the story was a beginning and a middle and an end. He didn't like the fact that they went and turned it into a movie, and then turned it into a series of new comics, and then turned it into a TV show. He was not supportive of that at all. So I feel a little bit of sympathy for him, knowing that his artistic vision's been compromised. But it was really amazing. It was so well done. It was a fascinating and absolutely engrossing bit of television. It was only 9 episodes, I think. Damon Lindelof said today, he said, I'm done. I only wanted to tell this one story. This is all I had to say. And then after winning the Emmys, people were like, well, you won the Emmys. Maybe you should do more. He was like, no, because I won the Emmys even more, I don't want to do more. It's perfect. I want to walk away with my head up. So yeah, it's a good thing to see a show like that get recognized, and it's the first time that any comic book based series has won Emmy for best anything.
Oh wow!
All right.
So I mean, Game of Thrones is a book, right? A lot of things have been adapted from books. This is the first thing that's been adapted from a comic book that's won best.
So that's where the history statement comes in?
That is the history statement, yeah.
Hmm.
In other Emmy news, The Dark Crystal, the amazing Age of Resistance, this glorious, beautiful, wondrous revision of The Dark Crystal for Netflix, won the Emmy Award for Best Kids Programming and was canceled.
Right.
I decided to save my rage from social media so that I could have a little bit of it here. So if you'll permit me just a moment on the soapbox. Sure. What a bleeping bad idea this is. That show was amazing. It was so beautiful. This so vivid and fully realized. So fresh and original. I'm disgusted that they're not doing more. I understand why they might not want to, because obviously there's, you know, it's probably very expensive. Obviously it's very time consuming. There's probably lots of factors for why you wouldn't want to do that. Maybe the ratings weren't as good as they needed to be to justify it either, but it was not meant to be a one and done like The Watchmen. It was meant to be a story that had more to say, and the fact that they're not going to be able to do that breaks my heart. I am so mad that they've canceled the series. Have you guys watched?
I definitely watched the first season. Loved it. I've got some Funko Pops from of some of the characters. And the thing that strikes me as weird is there's a very, very large investment in building the sets and the puppets that I would have thought, sort of very similar to how sort of expensive something like even traditional animation for Star Trek Lower Decks is. They just sort of, you know, pre-ordered 2 seasons worth because it's easier to amortize the costs over that, right? Just assume if you're going to do even one, you can get 2 seasons for just a little bit more. I would have thought that if they were looking at this and said, you know, we're going to go ahead and make this series, you would have at a minimum 2 seasons. And if the ratings that say they weren't good enough given the cost, I still would have said, well, all right, what can you do with season 2? Don't build any new puppets. Reuse puppets you've got, right? Just do it as cheap as possible. Yeah. Right, because it was already a minimum cost, right? They're not going to rebuild all the puppets. So given that big expense, I'm very, very shocked that they didn't keep it, especially after winning an Emmy. And I'm hoping that given that it came from Jim Henson's company, I'm hoping that the relationship with Disney for the Muppets, maybe Disney Plus will pick this up. That's what I'm hoping for.
That was my hope too. And I wasn't clear because I know that they bought the rights to the Muppets. So I'm not even sure how that relationship was set up with Netflix to begin with. And maybe that, Jaime, is a really good point. Maybe that was part of the decision making, was that there was a relationship, or there wasn't a relationship, and now there is a relationship. So they were obliged to do one season, but they don't have to do two or something. I don't know.
Yeah, I hope it continues. And it's not like we haven't seen different shows jump from, you know, one broadcaster to another. So it's not unprecedented. So I'm really hoping that somebody picks this one up.
Well, I mean, and as I said before, shows aren't necessarily made by the stations that show them, right? So it could be that it could get picked up. As a side story, I saw here too that the director apparently saved all the puppets from a massive fire somewhere too. So they do live, as it were.
Mm-hmm. I'm just gutted. The fact that it took so long to get somebody to continue that universe, and that it was done with such reverence and such love for that world and for the characters. I mean, if you watched any of the behind the scenes stuff that they put on Netflix as well, like, you can just feel, and even when you're watching the show, you can feel the love, the care, the detail that everyone from the, you know, the people who wrote the story, to the people who are the puppeteers, the people who are doing all the designs and costumes and sets, and it just seemed like they were investing so much of their care and love in it. And it just, again, it's just devastating to have been teased with a taste of that world, and to think that you were probably going to get more, and then have that rug pull out from under you. And speaking of having the rug pull out from under you, or the cape, as it were, Supergirl. In a bit of a surprise move this week, we found out that Supergirl is going to end after this upcoming season. So they didn't really give a specific reason. Lots of very nice things all said by everyone. Oh, it was a great show, and, you know, we're happy, we want to go out on top and everything else. Only 6 seasons by the time they're done this final one. So shorter than Arrow, shorter, you know, than I think people were sort of expecting. It could be to do with the fact that Melissa Benoist has become a mom, and maybe she doesn't want to commit to being on a busy, demanding schedule of being the top talent on a TV show. Mm-hmm. Or it could just be that it's, you know, again, it's expensive, or it could be COVID, you know, related, that it's just difficult to get people in and out because, you know, American crew or American talent, and it's shot in Canada, and maybe there's some logistical issues. Although it says that they're going to get back to shooting soon here in Vancouver. But again, a bit of a bummer. I've really, really enjoyed that show. I wasn't sort of sure what to expect from it, but again, that show is made with such people who are so passionate about it. You can really feel it jump off the screen. Those people really, really enjoy their work. And
yeah, definitely.
And I'm really upset that that one's going, but I'm glad that that one at least gets 20 episodes. They're going to do one more 20 episode season to try and wrap it up. Now, the hope there is that 20 episodes actually get produced, that there isn't another COVID lockdown or anything else that derails that. But
yeah, I've always been a Super Persons fan. I mean, like, that's one of the comic books I read when I was a kid too, right? Superboy and Superman and you know, the old the black and white TV show or serial, I guess. Mm-hmm. I guess it was a movie out in TV. Was it it was probably a movie serial before it was on TV, but with what's his name? That
George Reeves,
yeah. You know, and then even the remakes in the 70s where Superman actually learns to fly and all that mm-hmm. kind of stuff, and with Chris Reeves, right? And
one Reeve.
I know, I've always sort of been a fan of this show because Supergirl is another character I like. There never was a Superwoman, right?
But not in the shows.
But in the comics there were?
In the comics there's been, not very long. You know, more sporadic. Supergirl has been the sort of preeminent female.
The main one. Superboy and Krypton?
Krypto.
What was the name of his dog?
Krypto.
Krypto, yeah. I was right the first time. I used to read that when I was a kid. But
do you remember her? She had a pet too. Do you remember what her pet's name was?
I don't know if I read her. She had blonde hair, blonde hair, right? And sort of mini skirt kind of thing.
Yep.
I can't remember.
Mm-hmm. She had Streaky, the super cat. Streaky.
Oh, I thought it was maybe Nightmare of the Horse. No, that was
That's Wendy Casper. That's Wendy and Casper, yeah.
I thought there was a super horse, though.
There is a super horse. There's a whole bunch of super pets.
Secretariat, was that the super horse's name? Secretariat,
yes, that's right. Yep.
Anyway,
yeah.
All right, let's carry on with the cancellation talk.
No. This next one's not cancellation. Jaime's got one.
Oh, okay.
He's going to break the cancellation streak.
All right, we'll get back to that.
Yeah, and it's actually pretty good timing because I did look up to see where in the world is Brave New World. Why haven't I watched it? It's like, because it's on Peacock, which is NBC Universal.
Yes, right. Now that you mentioned it, right. Yeah.
And fans of the show may have forgotten that I am a Roku device user, so I literally could not get Peacock as a service on my device because Comcast and Roku were fighting over over the money. But they did, after months of negotiations, come to an agreement. And supposedly, although I've not checked, you can download the Peacock streaming service channel on your Roku device. So there you go. It's both a follow-up and a news item all in one.
Nice. That's nice. Cool. All right.
Still no word on when it'll arrive in Canada or if it will arrive in Canada.
Well, just like you said, though, it does say a Peacock production at the beginning of Brave New World, now that you mention it.
So what are you watching it on, Tim? Which service is it?
Television?
I know, but it's which channel?
Showcase.
Showcase, yeah. So that's often what happens to us up here is they will sell things off piecemeal, right? They'll do, you know, one show goes to this network, one show goes to that network. Whoever pays the most in syndication rights, right?
Yeah. Yep. Well, like I said, I remember watching something on TV a long, long time ago, maybe on CBC or something like that, about how TV shows get bought, and they go down to like LA and they watch, you know, limited runs of them, and they bid on them, mm-hmm. you know, like you said, and then that's how they get carried up here, whether it's Space or Showcase or Bravo or whatever, what have you, right?
Yeah, all the cable channels, yeah. No.
Bravo's still around?
I think so. I couldn't say.
I haven't seen Bravo in a while.
It's not on my radar.
Yeah. So, yeah, anyway.
Speaking of services, we have one to mourn and one reborn. DC Universe, we've talked about that over the past few weeks. DC Universe was the online service that was carrying some original programming, as well as being a place where you could watch the... or you could watch some back catalog of DC-related products, cartoons, TV shows, and stuff like that. You also got access to all kinds of comic books, and they had an exclusive store where you could buy some exclusive merch and stuff like that, all for a low monthly fee. Unfortunately, as we predicted with the unveiling of the HBO Max app and the news that a bunch of the content from DC Universe was going over there, they've decided to pull the plug. So DC Universe is dead. However, DC Universe Infinite has been reborn from the ashes and apparently is going to be a more comic-centered app. So it's going to be the place, like not unlike the Marvel app, where you can actually go and get a huge back catalog, see more content. So they've committed to doing more there. So I guess it's kind of a win-win. They're going to give people the continuation of, you can still watch Doom Patrol and Titans and Stargirl and some of the things that were on there that people were enjoying, but they're going to move those over to HBO. And then in this case, you can continue the other kinds of stuff if you pick up this new Disney Universe Infinite app. Apparently it is going to be changing in the new year, January. And so it's $8 a month or $75 a year. You get nearly every DC comic in their back catalog. New issues come they're 6 months after publication in store. And they're actually going to go international with it finally, because that was one of my biggest pet peeves, was that they launched this app and they made their content available, but you couldn't get it up here. So I can't read their digital comics catalog. It has never been made available. So the nice thing is you'll be able to do that up here. The other nice thing is that they're doing it as an add-on service too. So if you already have a subscription to this new this new DC app, you'll be able to add HBO Max for $5 a month if you were already a subscriber. So they're bundling, which is what we talked about. So you'll end up saving, I guess, $10 a month all in if you have both of those in a bundle. So Not bad.
I was kind of wondering if it was like one of these things where you bought books under one umbrella, would you be able to get them under another one, right? So,
well, I'm not sure. So the way that the unlimited stuff works is that you don't own it. You're essentially just, it's like Netflix, right? You basically, you can watch it, you can download it, you can take it with you, but it's not yours. Whereas for Comixology and things like that, you buy it, you own it, you can read it on multiple things. Like I can read stuff that I bought on Comixology on the DC app, but that's because I actually own them. But I can't do the stuff that's on the unlimited stuff because it's not available in Canada.
Yeah, it's like, you know, it's interesting you mentioned that, because I know I have bought some digital comic books over the years, and I have no idea where they are, how to get to them now that, you know, things have changed and apps have disappeared and what have you, right?
So yeah, and they used to offer a lot of them when they were first sort of trying some of the technology in the early 2000s. They used to offer a lot of things just on websites and, yeah, free downloads and other stuff. But yeah, a lot lot of that stuff, you know, it just gets moved around and they change technologies. And, you know, unless you sort of stay right on top of it, you may as well just go get it again.
So how does this affect actual comic books itself? Like, well, I mean, obviously now we can't go to the comic book store because of COVID.
And... Well, you certainly can. Comic book stores are still open. I was at my local last week and I went to see a different store last weekend. The comic stores are still out there. They need your business. So, you know, everyone out there, please go visit your local comic store and support them during this. And a lot of stores are doing like curbside pickup and things like that too. So even if you can't go in and browse, a lot of places are letting you browse. Basically, when you go in, they just ask that you disinfect your hands, you wear your mask while you're in there, and you can go browse the back issues and do everything you'd normally do because you're, you know, more or less safe. But some are doing curbside pickup and things like that. If you don't want to expose yourself to those kind of places, you can certainly, you know, arrange to, they'll, you know, you pay for your books with your, you know, debit or credit card online or on the phone with them, and you can just drive up. They'll bring your books out, put them in your, you know, trunk, and you can drive away.
So you used to have a box at one of the places you used to go to. Do you still do that? Like where you have a,
yep. Yeah,
a subscription, a lot of places call it a pull list. Next issue?
Yeah, you get a pull list. So basically, some places have gone to a digital pull list where there's a subscription. It's called League of Comic Dorks, I think, or something like that. League of, I'll have to look it up. We may have to correct that. Actually, I can look. I have it right here. But basically, the way they set it up is that you can go and get this stuff. LeagueofComicGeeks.com is the one that works for my local. So shout out to Comic Connection in Oakville. The way they have it set up is that you can go on basically months ahead of time and basically click on everything you want to be put aside for you. That way they know how much to pre-order to make sure that they have enough copies, and they can tell if something's hot. They can order a few extras so that they have some for the stands, and they basically put them into a bunch of boxes at the front of the store. And then, I mean, I've known the owner of my local store since we were both like 15 years old, so he knows me when I come in. And then you just say, hey, I want my last few months of books or weeks of books or however long it's been since the last visit. They drag them out and, you know, they're all pre-saved for you. The bigger issue is, and we talked about this before, DC sort of downsizing its editorial at its offices. You asked what this means for comics in general. You can still buy comics in the store, and comics in the store are still sought after by a lot of collectors and readers. What this means in the big picture, I don't know. Maybe this is part of a bigger push to try and get more people to do digital comics and less people to do the collectible side and the reading side in physical copies. I'll be curious to see where it goes. I'm still not a huge fan of digital comics. I do have some, and I have enjoyed reading some, but for me, part of it is the tactile experience. And I think maybe my generation might be the last that cares about that stuff, but it is still, for me, kind of part of the fun. That being said, I have too many comic books put aside, but still.
I mean, like from a business point of view, like the whole magazine trade has fallen flat on its face, and yeah. We know what's going on with news journalism and stuff like that. But I mean, like is it still a physical service that people go and buy? I mean, like if you go to Fan Expo or whatever, it's like they're all over the place and people are signing art and mm-hmm. signing books and stuff like that. I just wondered if the book market has dropped off significantly.
Well, there's been a shift over the last 20 years because originally it was, you know, it was serialized. It was monthly. You bought a comic once a month and it continued the story and you read it and it kept going. And sometimes there were limited series and sometimes they had been going for 70 years. And you sort of jumped into the middle of it. The, I guess, question is, you know, so things went from buying it month to month to a lot of people waiting for the collected editions, which are sometimes referred to as trade paperbacks or, you know, collected editions, omnibus, or, you know, whatever you want to call them. It's basically an entire storyline in one volume. And that's where things shifted a little bit, because not only was it easier for people to wait and not buy it month to month, which kind of eats into your regular monthly comics, but it also means that places that are bookstores and online retailers could get into the market a lot more easily than they would on monthly issues, where, you know, people have certain expectations of promptness and everything else. You can build a huge warehouse catalog full of all these, you know, trade paperbacks and then pump them out. So that was a huge shift. The next huge shift may be to go from people waiting for that to people getting the Netflix type subscription services or the DC Universe Infinite or Comixology or whatever it is, where you get unfettered access for a certain amount per month, just like you do on, you know, any, you know, name Apple Music, name any kind of service like that, where you can access all the catalog and read whatever you want, whenever you want. And maybe that's where things go. And maybe that's where the next generation of comic fans sort of comes to and sort of develops their love. But it, again, part of the thing of comics is it's twofold. One, it's a reading material. Two, it's a collectible. The collectible thing dies when you have the online stuff. So are you shooting yourself in the foot? You'd be killing an entire industry of, you know, resellers and book collectors and sell, and like all that stuff goes out. I don't know if that whole world is ready to implode yet. So thank you. I'll put my soapbox away now.
All right.
Next one I've got is, so speaking of DC Universe, we got our first taste from DC Fandom of the Suicide Squad's second movie. And it looks really good, and they basically did a roll call showing off all these characters and the actors who are going to play them. And one of the ones that was kind of a surprise for people was John Cena is going to have an appearance in Suicide Squad as Peacemaker. Peacemaker, a bit of an obscure character, sort of, you know, some of us who are deep in the DC, you know. He was an old Charlton Comics character. DC bought all the Charlton characters' rights. That included Captain Atom, Blue Beetle, Peacemaker, and they absorbed them during Crisis on Infinite Earths in 1986. They absorbed all those characters into the DC Universe so they could then continue those stories onward. Peacemaker was, even then, a little bit of an obscure character. The idea is that this person is such an extreme pacifist that he resorts to violence to promote peace. Bit of a quandary on that one. Bit of a weird story. So interesting that they were going to even include it in Suicide Squad, but what they've decided to do is, coming next year to HBO Max, they're going to do a spin-off series starring John Cena as Peacemaker. He said to resounding silence.
It's very weird because it's putting a lot on the idea that this is going to be a breakout character for the movie.
Yeah, and again, John Cena is very much, I think, liked. He has his own built-in audience, not unlike Dwayne Johnson from the WWE stuff. And I mean, yeah, maybe without seeing the movie, it's hard to say, but maybe he's got, you know, maybe he's a scene stealer. Maybe he's really great in that. And they were like, okay, great, let's greenlight this. Interesting timing that they already announced it. Apparently they haven't filmed anything yet. It's going to start filming next year, and it's supposed to be out by the end of next year. But yeah, very strange choice of characters of all the things you thought they would spin out of there. I mean, it would make more sense to have done a, you know, the breakout stars from that first movie were, you know, Harley Quinn, Deadshot, even, you know, Captain Boomerang was a bit of a scene stealer and some of those things. So a bit of a strange choice, but again, maybe John Cena and his sort of star power is enough to propel this into something good. Next up, some sad news. And yeah, this one was a strange one because I didn't know much about this person, and in spite of a pretty prodigious career. So we had a death this week. It was a man named Ron Cobb. And Ron Cobb was a designer for a lot of movies. He was an underground cartoonist who sort of caught on and started doing some work on some different science fiction projects over the years. So his obituary is up on Hollywood Reporter. We'll have it in our show notes. So he is responsible for designing several of the characters for the Star Wars Cantina, most notably the character that those of us who are old enough know as Hammerhead, who definitely, he got a name later on in the alternate canon and stuff like that. He also worked on Alien. He designed the ship in Alien. He designed the look of the time machine for Back to the Future. He worked with Steven Spielberg on some of the concepts for E.T. that eventually sort of changed how that story was told. He worked on The Abyss. He worked on Close Encounters, including the design of the inside of the mothership. He worked on True Lies, Last Starfighter. He worked on Conan the Barbarian. I mean, this guy was everywhere in science fiction and fantasy in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s. And yeah, again, one of those people I didn't know that much about. When we read this obituary talking about how, you know, he was influential and working on all these things to, you know, sort of be the visionary behind all this stuff. It's amazing. He unfortunately passed away this week. He had dementia, and he was 83 years old. And for somebody who I didn't know, I now know a lot more about him, and I'm a lot sadder for his loss, because this guy brought a lot of stuff to us.
Yeah, it looks familiar.
Yeah, it's I can't recall. It was someone in one of the comments in one of the boards I was on said he is one of the special features. I'll try and find it. He is in one of the special features things for one of the movies, and they said like his insight into like how things were designed and why they were done and everything else was utterly fascinating. And so now I'm really keen to look it up. But yeah, this guy had such a, like, I mean, think to have designed or worked on one of those things would have been remarkable. To design all those things, that is an astonishing career.
Yeah, for sure. Especially, I mean, the Nostromo was such an interesting ship too, right? From the very beginning.
Absolutely. And again,
except for the fact where they wore the masks and they were not plugged into anything.
Well, yeah.
But,
Yeah, and then the time machine and Back to the Future is one of the most iconic things in all of pop culture. Yeah. Like, yep. That's huge. That's massive. So,
yeah, for sure.
Rest in peace, our man Ron Cobb.
Yep. Australian. All righty. Well, I guess since you guys have been canceling all these shows, I can't just leave it alone. So here's my cancellation. Star Trek IV is canceled.
Again?
And Paramount is saying that they're not going to be making any Star Trek, no longer. This is what the headline says. No longer making Star Trek movies. No longer is a long time.
That is a long time. Yeah. It sounds permanent.
Does sound permanent. But I think, is this all around the fact that Chris Pine doesn't want to come back, or what the story is?
Well, they've been talking about this for a while, that there was a lot of sort of different pushes and pulls. There was some talk they were going to do the Tarantino rumored version.
Right, yeah.
There was some talk that they were going to do a continuation of the Chris Pine, Zach Quinto stuff. And they really couldn't seem to get it together. And it sounded like at one point they were really close to a deal to do more. I know Simon Pegg had been really involved and were doing some writing. But and then the last thing they were talking about was Noah Hawley, the guy who did what's the name of that weird show? Well, he did Fargo. Noah Hawley did the Fargo television show, and then he did that one with the it was the X-Men spinoff. Oh, guys, I'm drawing a blank. Help me out. The one where he has like he's in the mental patient. All right, you can delete all this. I'm going to look it up.
Is it Legion?
Legion. Thank you very much. Legion. Yes. So, which, again, was a real, like, bizarro show. Really excellent, but really weird. So I was kind of keen to have seen what he was going to bring to the Star Trek universe. But apparently that's now out the window, too. So hard to say if this is a good or a bad thing. I would have been nice if they could have at some point reconciled the whole split timeline, you know, what does it all mean kind of thing. Because there is this now sort of just hanging out there. The whole original timeline, Kelvin timeline, you know.
Yeah.
And it didn't really end in a terribly satisfactory way after the last Star Trek movie. It wasn't like that was like, and done.
With the Wrath of Khan version?
No, they did that in...
Oh, no. Yeah, yeah. They did the goofy one. Yeah, right.
Goofy one, yes.
With the motorcycles. And...
Yes. Yeah, the one by the guy from who did the Fast and Furious, right?
Is that who that was?
I think so. Wasn't it the Fast and Furious guy? That's why it had the motorcycles, yeah.
Yeah, it was silly. It was kind of like what was that, Insurrection? Was that the one where Data goes bananas?
Yes, because that's the one where they are like trying to protect that planet. And
yeah. I remember watching that one in the theater thinking, this is a TV show.
Yeah,
on the big screen, you know.
Yeah, like, well, yeah, very unsatisfying. So that one didn't really have one way or the other. It was just sort of, yeah, let's make a movie because we can make movies.
Yeah. Was that the one, was that after the one with the new James Bond with Picard and his clone?
Tom Hardy,
yeah.
No, Tom Hardy was the last one. That was the final. Okay. Nemesis was the last one.
Yeah.
So it was Generations, First Contact, Insurrection, and Nemesis were the four. So
did I drop a spoiler when I mentioned James Bond?
Do you know something and we don't know? Has that been made official?
I'm surprised you don't know. Tom Hardy was announced as the new James Bond, or is rumored to be.
Oh, see, yeah. Rumored I'd heard. I hadn't heard concrete.
Yeah.
Have you got an inside tip? Do you know?
No, Tom? No. I heard this like last week.
Did he put on a mask to do the delivery of it? Is he going to be wearing a mask while he mumbles his way through Bond lines too?
I don't know. Mark Turner. All right. Anyway, hey, look where we are. We are at the moment of truth. We are at the point of the show where we start to talk about Star Trek Lower Decks, Season 1, Episode 8, Veritas. So this week, Jonathan's going to do the play-by-play, so we'll just sit back, relax. Here comes the drill. Jonathan, take it away.
I don't know that it's being referred to as the drill, but here we go. So this episode was busy. Lots of stuff going on in this one, but really well done, I think. We started off in the cold open where our gang of Lower Decks crew, Mariner, Boimler, Tendi, and Rutherford are finding themselves in this alien dungeon, and they're not sure why they're there or what's happening. They say they saw the bridge crew get taken to a separate room, and they're all sort of speculating on what they could, you know, what could have been that led them to getting stuck in this circumstance. Tendi thinks she's in there for replicating too much ice and that maybe the bridge crew also replicated too much ice. And yeah, it's a sort
really
of,
likes ice.
Yeah, really yeah. likes ice. It's a very sort of weird cold open because you're sort of like, what's happening? You're like being thrust into the middle of an episode. And then we cut to the opening credits. And when we pop back from that, the platform that they're on in this dungeon elevates them up and puts them in the middle of this room. And you immediately get these vibes, these Star Trek VI vibes, right? It feels very much like the scene where Kirk and McCoy are brought before the Klingon trial for killing the Chancellor, right? They're banging right. things, yep. The monster, rumbling voices, dark lighting. It seems very foreboding, and it has very much that same ambiance of the sort of sham trial that they were being put on. And they look up and they see the bridge crew, the senior officers are all being suspended in this beam. And Mariner says immediately, well, this must be a trial. This alien comes out, and immediately, the first word out of his mouth, you're like, oh my, there he is. It's Kurtwood Smith, who we mm-hmm. knew was going to be on an episode this season. Kurtwood Smith, again, of course, most famously probably That 70s Show, the dad on That 70s Show. And for the rest of us, he was the Chancellor of the Federation in Star Trek VI, another Star Trek VI callback. And
but his voice sounds so comic cartoony. Like,
well, he's definitely going over the top on it. He's playing it big.
Well, I looked at his profile, and he's done a lot of voiceover work. So because he definitely sounded like those, you know, those stock guys who did the 70s voiceovers and stuff like
yep,
that. And,
yep.
you know, meanwhile, back mm-hmm, at the... Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, you know, at the Hall of Justice.
At the Hall of Justice. Yeah, those kind of voices, right? So
Yeah, he does have one of those voices.
Yeah, because I didn't immediately clue in that it was Kirkwood Smith. In fact, not until I saw the credits, but I did realize that it was sort of that warm, you know, glass of warm milk and cookies mm-hmm. kind of familiar feeling, right?
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely familiar. It definitely feels like somebody you've known for a long time.
Yeah, exactly.
So he, this alien comes out and he's got an eye patch and he's kind of scary looking, and you hear this sort of banging that's like, you know, metal against metal. He's banging this sort of gavel type thing. And he says, you know, hey, you know, I brought forward you to be witnesses to speak truth about your senior officers. And, you know, the question pops out, what's the difference between witnessing and just looking at something? He says, you have to speak into the Horn of Kandor, one of our most sacred horns, and you must only speak the truth. And so he wants to know about these certain star dates. So he starts with Mara and he starts grilling her, and he says, you know, you were on the bridge of the Cerritos when they made contact with the Klicket ship Twi'erk. And so Mariner starts explaining her story, what happened on Stardate 57818.4. And she says, we were in the repair bay. Yeah, 0.4. Very menacing. We were in the repair bay and they were having a discussion. They're talking about who was the biggest all-time badass. And Boimler says, well, clearly it's Roga Danar. And Mariner's not having it. Oh, what are you talking about? Roga Danar. So, of course, immediately I'm like, I know that name. Where do I know that name from? So I popped it into Google, Roga Danar. I'm like, oh, there it is. It's from TNG Season 3. It's the episode The Hunted. And it's about those guys who were trained to be the perfect warriors. They chemically altered them, everything else. And he's the guy who was like the one who kept evading capture. And then he, the his people were going to apply for Federation citizenship, but, you know, in the end, they basically leave them to sort out their own squabbles, and he ends up being this, you know, sort of thorn in them getting into the Federation. So he is a badass, but as pointed out immediately after that, you know, Mariner says, Khan, come on, Khan, dude was the space seed, yeah. Which again, nice callback. Tendi says, oh, when I come back in a second, I want to talk about Khan's thick chest.
Right, but I gotta pee.
So great. I mean, just a great sub-reference of a sub-reference of, like, obscurity and, like, yeah, deep cuts. Real deep cuts. Star Trek
apparently
stuff.
That really was his chest, believe it or not.
I mean, I had no doubt. I mean, come on. Ricardo Montalban? Dude was a beast.
Yeah.
So Tendi goes to the door because she's going to walk out and she's going to go to the bathroom. And it's a red alert. And then she comes back and says, guys, there seems like there's a red alert. And they're like, no. If there's a red alert, the alarms be going off. And Rutherford says, well, yeah, especially because I changed the speakers in here so it'd be extra loud so we'd know definitely when there was a red alert. And they went, oh, Rutherford, you mess with the speakers. They open the door to the repair bay, and sure enough, everybody else is like scrambling around getting to their posts, and they're like, oh no, what are we gonna do? So Boimler and Mariner, of course, have bridge duties. They're like, oh no, we're gonna get in trouble, we're late, we gotta run up to the bridge. And Mariner says, listen, you know, it's gonna be fine, don't panic, Boimler, we're gonna be fine, just whatever, go in there and just agree with whatever the captain says, and we'll be fine. And she has a great line where she says, you know, listen, do you want to get us in trouble? Do you want to get us kicked out of Starfleet? We'll have to go back to Earth. And we'll all have to live on Earth, where there's nothing to do except drink wine and hang out at vineyards and soul food restaurants, which again is a nice, nice dig. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, this seems like she's right. Like the only times they went back to Earth in TNG and Deep Space Nine were those of
the two. And the movies. And the movies.
That's where they seem to go. So they end up on the bridge, and the Captain Freeman is saying, you know, well, the Klickits attacked them after she thanked them for giving them a map of the neutral zone, the Romulan neutral zone. And while she's talking about this, Mariner and Boimler sneak in and slide into their seats at the front of the bridge. And the captain says, Mariner, I want your opinion. And she says, oh, you know exactly what to do, Captain. And you just go with your gut. And then so the captain says, Boimler, I want options. And he goes, Shaq slams his fist down. Come on, man, this is your chance. Prove you belong up here. He goes, well, I guess it would be captain's choice. She says, don't kiss my ass. He says, there are no wrong answers. He says, well, how about evasive maneuver 88? And the doctor looks and says, is he effing serious? And beep. The captain says,
there were a lot of beeping in this show. Yeah,
the sure. captain says, that's the wrong answer. Like 10 seconds after saying there's no wrong answers, he goes, how about 84? Oh, no, I'm just kidding. How about impulse drive to a crazy Ivan? Ransom looks at him and says, son, now you're just embarrassing yourself. Again, really nice, just Boimler stuttering and muttering his way through his, you know, experience, trying not to, you know, explode at getting taken to school. So the captain says, never mind. Mariner, send our friends a message. And Mariner says, I got this, and fires a blast, a phaser blast right underneath the ship. And the captain says, what the hell? What are you doing? I said to send them a message, to invite them to dinner. Everybody knows what that means. You're supposed to invite them to dinner. She says, no, it's not. Nobody knows that. That's not a thing. So, of course, the Klickits respond by firing at the bridge. And then we snap back to the trial where the alien interrupts, the Kurtwood Smith alien interrupts and says, I don't believe that the command crew wouldn't know what's happening on their ship at all times. Just like, forget about that. I want to know about the map. I want to know about this map you mentioned. And Mariner says, well, I don't know anything about that. So he picks her up, he hoists her up and says, you're going to be placed into the tank of contempt, which is this bubbling tank filled with eels. And Boimler jumps in front of the horn and says, no, we didn't see any map. And he says, fine, Mariner can go unealed. So Tendi is seeming a little squirmy. She's seeming a little nervous, but we're not sure why yet. So then the alien calls Rutherford, who he refers to as Samanthan Rutherford. I didn't know if we knew Samanthan was his name.
We did not, because I wrote that down. It stuck out to me as well.
Yeah. And he says, you tell me what happened on Stardate 57791.1. And so he says, you know, I was downstairs doing this work, and Shax and Billups, the chief engineer, show up, and they say, does your implant have Romulan flight manuals and repair info? And he says, no, but, you know, in order to do that, I'd need to do an update. And they said, you've got to do it now. We need you right now. And he says, no, well, actually, I prefer to do it when I'm sleeping. And we order you. You've got to do this right now. And he says, okay, fine, I'll set it up. So he starts setting it up, and he has like a 30-second countdown. And they said, oh, by the way, do you have all your shots? You know, you got to be careful. You're going to get Denobulan flesh-eating bacteria on your... And he says, wait, what? He says, oh, yeah, you got to be really careful with that. It'll eat right through your underpants. And just as he's sort of starting to freak out, he blacks out as his implant reboots itself. Wakes up. Sometime later, he's in a shuttle, and he's in disguise as a Vulcan, including a weird metallic ear stuck to the side of his implant, which is hilarious. And there's two almost naked Vulcans lying on the floor, and Shax is patting him on the shoulder, saying, good job giving that, you know, Vulcan neck pinch to those Vulcans, baby bear. I don't know why he calls him baby bear. I don't know if that's a throwback to the part where he was trying out for the security team in a previous episode, or where that comes from, but it made me laugh so hard that he calls him baby bear. So he says, we're headed for the museum, and he's, you know, Rutherford's freaked out. He's disoriented. He's not sure what's happening. And he says, okay, we gotta go. So they basically push him out the door with a parachute on, and, like, you know, send him down towards this museum. And of course he blacks out again. Pops back to consciousness. He's in the museum, and he's standing underneath a vintage Romulan bird of prey. Bird of prey? Warbird? What did he say? Bird of prey?
Bird of, I think it's a bird of prey is what I heard. Yeah.
And he is standing there, and Shax is shimmying up the leg of this thing, trying to get in. And he says, you know, careful we don't draw attention to ourselves. And the guard comes around the corner and says, hey, you've drawn my attention. And he says, what am I supposed to do now? He says, do the fan dance. So he's holding these feathers and does the fan dance, which is, that's Uhura's thing, right? Isn't that what Uhura did in Star Trek V?
Yeah.
The sort of cheesy fan dance. So he's trying to do the fan dance. Of course, he doesn't know what the heck he's doing. He's like, you know, waving these fans around, and the guard's like, what are you even doing? And
he's like, hey, you're distracting me.
Then, of course, his implant, you know, pops in again. Blacks out again. He wakes up, and he's standing in open space. And he says, why am I standing in space? And turns out he's standing on top of the cloaked ship. And he looks over to his one side, and he sees Billups. And Billups is acting really weird. And Billups says, oh, no, look out. Mark Twain's got a gun. No, the garbage bag's behind you, Tasha. No. So he's clearly, again, deep cutting TNG episodes. I'm not sure where those came from. Turns out he's got nitrogen intoxication. So he's basically running out of air to his brain. And so they drag him aboard this ship, and, or is it onto the shuttle, or is it onto the ship? Is it onto the bird of prey?
Bird of prey, I think.
Yeah. So, and then Shax helps him on board. And then, of course, his thing starts to kick in again. It says, now loading Klingon funds. He goes, why would I even need those? And it blacks out again. And he wakes up, and he's standing at what seems to be a wedding ceremony. And he walks up, he starts walking forward, and all the guests and the bride and groom turn around and look at him, and it's a Gorn wedding. Gorn wedding! And then he blacks it. He says, you know, oh, get me out of this implant. And he taps his implant, hoping his implant's going to save him as he's getting mauled by the Gorns. And it turns off and turns back on like 5 seconds later, and he's still getting mauled by the Gorns. So all this is going on. All of a sudden, he sort of snaps back into the trial again. And the Kurtwood's alien is still saying, you know, I don't want to know anything about a Gorn wedding. I don't care about Gorn weddings. I want to know about the details of this theft of the bird of prey. And Rutherford says, well, I don't know. I'm telling you everything I know. And he says, oh, that's it. Into the eels with you. So he again hovers him above the eels. Tendi jumps in. It's Tendi's turn. And she's excited. She's like, oh, I totally want to. I've always wanted to testify. So he says, did you and Commander Ransom go into the Romulan neutral zone? And she's like, can't say. It's a classified mission. And so he says, you know, threatens he's going to, you know, drop everybody in the eel. So she's, okay, fine, I'll tell you, but I'm going to have to edit certain things out because it's a classified mission. So she gets the assignment. She says she gets the assignment to clean the conference room. She's really excited. She gets to go clean the conference room. And Mariner, of course, says, you know, all you're going to be doing is cleaning cat hair off the chair. The chair is, of course, a reference to the doctor. And she says, no, that's going to be great. So she goes up. And she's happily, in her very happy, tendy way, cleaning stuff off the chairs and so excited that this is the captain's chair and this is the doctor's chair. And then into the door, in through the door, burst Ransom and three burly commandos, all dressed in black. And they say, oh, are you the cleaner? And she says, I am the cleaner. And they're like, well, we're glad you're here. It's time to talk about our classified mission. And Ransom basically says, we've got this map. The map's going to lead them into the neutral zone. And there's a very funny bleep in there where they're trying to bleep out neutral zone, but they completely miss, I guess, on purpose. Because she's trying to censor herself and doesn't. I don't know why that is done like that, but it's very funny. Tendi is sort of basically wrapped up. They throw her a phaser rifle and are like, great, we can't wait to have you come on this mission. And so they basically draft her into this mission where she clearly doesn't belong. She ends up on this ship, which turns out it's the Bird of Prey. And she's on there and they're all decked out in their, you know, spy gear, like the previous episode where they're wearing the, you know, black skull caps. She's trying to figure out how she can tell them that she's not the cleaner. And the Andorian, right? It's the Andorian commando keeps saying, interrupting her and saying, the Romulans are scanning us. Okay, well, what were you saying? Oh, never mind, the Romulans are scanning us again. Oh, sorry, what were you gonna say? Oh, never mind, the Romulans are scanning us again. And it just keeps, the more and more of these giant warships keep showing up and scanning at them. It turns out their mission is to Romulus, and they get to the Romulan. They go down to the planet. They're sneaking into this building for who knows what, and a little funny exchange between a couple of the guards who, you know who I hate? Reman. They commandos all go into the room and they say, you stay here, cleaner, you guard our six. She says, six what? Commandos come back bursting through the door, and they're being chased by a bunch of, you know, badass Romulan warriors all firing phasers, and they're like, you know, okay, do your thing. And she's like, do my thing? What am I supposed to do? Oh yeah. And she starts like wailing on these Romulans. She's kicking them all over, you know, martial arts, kicking them all over the place. And they said, why is she doing that? She was, her purpose of being here was supposed to beam us out, not to, you know, kick these guys' butts. All of a sudden, hard cut. We go right back to the trial. The alien says, you did not do martial arts on multiple armed guards. She says, you're right, I didn't. And she winks at him. And he says, okay, today didn't have to end in eels, but she picks her up and is going to drop her and Mariner and Rutherford into the thing full of eels. Spoosh, down they go. And then they turn on the burners. So there's burners boiling the water and there's eels in the water. And he says, what was in the package? What was in the package you got from the Romulan, you know, building? And the water's boiling and the eels start screaming, I think you're hurting the eels. So he says, tell me what the bridge crew did. And Boimler grabs the horn and says, we can't tell you what they did because we don't know. We never know anything. So he hoists the three of them out of the eel tank, and Boimler basically goes into his soliloquy and he says, we're lower decks. No one ever tells us what's going on. And the alien says, you know, that's lies. There's no way that they don't know what's going on. They're perfect. Your bridge crew is, you know, these amazing, perfect people. And he says, no. They mess up all the time. Boimler says, they mess up all the time. Like when Q shows up. So finally we get our long-awaited appearance of Q, which we were dying after that little tease at Star Trek Day. When are we going to see Q? And so John DeLancey as Q in his regalia from the encounter at Farpoint, first episode of TNG, pops onto the bridge of the Cerritos, and he beams out the bridge crew, a snap of a finger, and they find themselves wearing chess pieces as outfits, and they're standing on a chessboard across from playing cards. The playing cards have hockey sticks. There's a soccer ball on the board, and there's a set of football goalposts behind them. And Q basically says, you know, like, now this is, let's settle the are humanity worthy? Question of whether our humanity is worthy. And they're like, what game are we even supposed to be playing here? Oh, it's soccer. And then the soccer ball gets up, arms and legs pop out of it, and it starts singing at them. They're like, okay, that's weird. And then Boimler continues to elaborate. He says, and like when Ransom has his dates with these completely unresearched people. And so he's at the bar Bard. He's chatting up this attractive blonde at the bar on the ship, and Mariner leans over and says, you know that that's a salt vampire. And he goes, no, it's not a salt vampire. And of course, it is a salt vampire. Then, you know, and like the doctor, and the doctor is coming onto the bridge of what looks like the Cerritos. She runs across and says, you know, Captain, I've been going around the ship and all kinds of people and nobody knows what I am. I think we may have gone into an alternate universe. And of course, it's all of the bridge crew, including Mariner and Boimler, but all slightly different looking. And he says, did you get on the wrong ship? This is the Alhambra. And, you know, oh, damn it. She can't get all these ships look the same. So we cut back, and these are all great, say, very funny, goofy, over the top segues. I'd like the Boimler character looks like a mosquito. Like, it's just, it's so over the top. And we cut back to the trial, and the alien is just fuming, and he's just saying, you know, no, the bridge crew are perfect. They don't need that. And Boimler says, no, they're not perfect, and it's okay. We all joined Starfleet. We wanted to embrace the unknown. Like, do you think Picard knew about the Borg? Do you think Kirk knew about the giant Spock on Phylos? Do you think Dr. Crusher knew about that ghost in the lamp thing from that Scottish planet that she hooked up with that one time? Which is the best burn this show's done so far, because that episode is horrible.
Yeah.
And, you know, he says, you know, whatever the bridge crew did, I'm sure they did it for good. This trial is a sham. And the alien says, this isn't a trial. What makes you think this is a trial? This is a party. And he turns on the lights, and there's balloons and there's ribbons, and it looks like a child's birthday party. He says, it's a party for the crew that rescued me from the Romulans. And they cut to the Cerritos previously, and they open up the container that they got off out of the Romulan fort that they were in, and they say, well, welcome aboard Imperium Magistrate Klar. And he says, oh, thank you so much for saving me. I was imprisoned there for a year. He says, I have to take you back to K'tuvan Prime to celebrate so that you guys can have your great deeds etched into this history stone. And he says, how could you even think this was a trial? And they're like, you have our crew held in midair in the scary ass beam. He says, no, this is the beam of celebration. And Philip says, we are so honored to be up here in this beam. He says, no, this is Alien Trial 101. You've got this creepy ass building. He says, this is one of our nicest silos. I have my wedding here. He says, what about that guy up there? That creepy judge type. And he says, no, I was just here early. I'm here to set up for my daughter's birthday. She's turning 100. And then in comes, I guess the manager of the facility comes in and says, okay, Klar, your 22 minutes are up. Again, a nice funny reference to the length of TV shows. Your 22 minutes are up. You're going to have to go. And he says, you know, oh no, but we didn't even get to do any etching. He says, you know, you ruined my party. And so they cut back to the ship. They're back on the Cerritos. And the Lower Decks crew are there with the bridge crew. And the captain says, you know, I've been thinking about what you guys were saying, and maybe we need to work on more transparency. We need to have a little more openness here. So from now on, I'm going to try and keep you guys in the loop. They said, great. So we have some questions. So why was Klar a prisoner of the Romulans to begin with? She goes, he said, well, and why, if you knew that this was a party, did you let him hurt us with eels? She says, well, actually, that's, you know, we didn't want to interrupt. Ransom says, we didn't want to interrupt their customs. And so who was it that was on that infiltration team? And why did they have to steal the ship? Why didn't they just borrow it? And Captain finally loses her temper and says, listen, it's all classified. Everything is classified. We're not going to tell you any of this. Now get out. And they're like, fine, it's fine, we didn't care anyways. And as they're walking down the hallway, Boimler says, you know, I knew that wasn't even a trial. And Mariner says, well, if you knew it wasn't a trial, why were you crying? He says, I have sensitive corneas, you know that. And Q appears, whoosh, in his usual flash of light, and right in front of the Lower Decks crew, and says, I challenge you to a duel. Choose your weapons. I pick the mind. And Mariner, who's clearly on her last wits, says, get out of here, Q. We're done with random crap today. Why don't you go bug Picard? He says, aw, Picard's no fun. He's always quoting Shakespeare. He's always making wine. And then we fade to black. What a funny, goofy, hilarious, Star Trek loaded episode this was.
Oh, and the bleepy bleep bleeping.
Oh, absolutely.
Bleep, bleep, bleep. Was really, really well timed.
This was again, it was packed. What a dense episode. I'm sorry if my recap was long, but there was so much packed into this episode.
Yeah, for sure.
Like all the digressions, all the little characters, the references, there was so much stuff in there. They must have referenced like, 10 different things that were, from previous movies, episodes and everything else. And then, so
even
funny.
The helmet that the guy was wearing in the guard that was being distracted, that was a Vulcan helmet from the Amok time, that Bok went through.
Jaime, what'd you think of this one?
I thought it was great for a couple different things. It had some stuff that was, in this modern era of smartphones and stuff where you try to do updates and it reboots and hangs like several times. It's like, Klingon fonts, why would I need that? It was like, had me, burst out laughing. It's like, why does it need to, reboot and therefore knock me out just for that? That doesn't seem necessary. And the other part I liked was, if you follow any criticism of the show, whether it's this particular show or Discovery or Picard, this episode felt like it was about turning directly to the camera and addressing criticisms about, like, look, these individuals didn't know these things. They weren't perfect. They didn't act perfect. They didn't have all the information that the audience has, which can definitely apply to this as an individual show and also the Star Trek franchise as a whole.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's very meta, this one. Yeah, I mean, again, win all over the place here. Again, very funny episode. Each of the characters gets a nice little bump in the episode. Again, perfectly illustrates the whole Lower Decks concept, right? Like, we just work here. We're not the ones that make decisions. We just work here. And again, to get Kurtwood Smith, who's, again, a great, great actor and a great voice actor, clearly, mixed in with, again, adding John DeLancey as a cameo, as Q. I mean, and the Gorn wedding, like, there's so much mm-hmm. to laugh at in this episode.
But the subtle things, like when they get to the bridge and they're in the turbo lift, Mariner buttons up her neck, which she always has her uniform undone, sort of thing, right?
Yeah. So, but she doesn't roll down her sleeves because she refuses to because her mom wants her to.
Right. I forgot about that. Yeah, she got in trouble for that.
That's right. Because that's what Ransom puts her in the brig, right? For not rolling down her sleeves.
Rolling down her sleeves.
The Dr. Crusher burn, though, was the funniest thing. I laughed, and Xavier was looking at me like I was mental. Like, I just couldn't stop laughing because it's such a wicked burn that all of us who are old school TNG fans were like, yes, 100% yes on that thing. That was the most confounding episode, maybe, of the entire TNG run. What is even happening here? Like, why?
I'm sure even Gates McFadden kind of wondered about that one too.
Yeah, I don't know how that one even made it to let's make this into a show, but to have thrown that in with Picard and the Borg and Kirk and Spock and then to do that one was such a wicked burn.
Yeah. All right.
Two episodes to go. This season seems to have flown by.
Wow, yeah. Sure.
But I'm so very happy to know that already they're working on a season two. And I hope this runs for a long time because I love this show. I'm already 100%
in. Well, it's funny. Yeah, you're right. Because, I mean, it's funny because, like Star Trek takes itself way too seriously, right?
Yeah, it's so earnest.
Yeah. And so this is such a sort of, tongue firmly planted in cheek kind of shot at itself, right?
Yeah. But it's about time. This seems like it's long overdue for them to take a bit of the starch out and just realize that for some people, of course, it's a job. It's a thing to do. It's not their, life and everything. It's for some people it's, oh man, I have to wipe the cat hair off the doctor's chair,
or even the voice of the real on the substitute ship, the voice of the doctor who looks at the cat doctor is the same person's voice. Yeah. Right,
it's the male version of Captain Freeman with the goatee, where you're supposed to just for a second you look at it and you're like, oh, is it an alternate universe thing,
with and the dreadlocks
then, and then you look at the rest of them and you're like, oh, I get what's going on here.
Because you barely see them. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
What was the name of the ship that she mentioned? La Horna or something?
I wrote it down in here.
Alhambra is what
Alhambra, yeah. We have a translation for Alhambra?
A palace and fortress complex located in Granada in Spain.
There you go.
Alhambra is? Or Alhambra?
Alhambra is.
Alhambra, well, but
the, right?
But was it a California class ship? Maybe it's a place in California. I mean,
all right, look up Alhambra. You're getting real-time follow-up here, kids. We're digging in.
There is a Alhambra, California. Where is that? Where are you? Los Angeles area.
There you go. You'll find it. That's where the show's creator lives or something. There'll be some little subtle after reference. I hope at some point they do a behind the scenes kind of thing with this, or a commentary or something. This one seems like it would be amazing if you could get like the DVD box set with the commentary on and stuff, just all the behind the scenes, you know, people talking about this stuff, because it seems like it would be a hoot. Even that stuff from Star Trek Day when they just had the stars and the creator around doing like a round table was really fun and funny. They clearly all like each other and have a good time, and you get that vibe in the show, but it seems like it would be a fun crew to just have them sit around and talk about the work.
Yeah, and they seem to have a lot of fun with the voiceover work that they're doing, so very expressive. Tendi's turning out to be a really interesting character.
Yeah, I feel like there's more to her. I feel like they've sort of dipped into her a little bit, but I feel like she's still a little untapped. They have obviously spent a little more time with Mariner and Boimler, who are sort of the A pairing versus Rutherford and Tendi. But yeah, I agree. I think she's an interesting character that I think they can do more with.
Well, it's definitely sort of that same sort of formula as, you know, Big Bang Theory, kind of with the four, in this case, there's four people instead of five, but that same sort of, you know,
Leonard and Sheldon and Howard and Raj.
Yeah, or the friends people, you know, the divided by two, whatever, -2, right?
Yeah. There definitely seems to be a little more sort of prominent. Again, Tawny Newsome and Jack Quaid are the, you know, the 1-2 on the credits list too, right?
Yeah.
So I guess they're sort of that titch above, but yeah, I think it's good that they've been giving them all, like, they really have sort of built on the characters too. Like, even with Rutherford, the little throwaway scene where he's setting up when he gets, you know, called to go on that mission, where he's downstairs and he's rotating the, I can't remember what he said, he's rotating.
EPS.
Yeah. Gotta rotate them, otherwise, and he starts singing a song to himself. Again, it all fits with the character that they've established already for the first 7 or 8 episodes.
Or that he fixed the red alert sirens.
Yeah,
and that's when they all look at him and go, oh, of course.
Yeah.
That's why we're not hearing it.
Yeah. So yeah, again, it's building on these sort of characters that they're establishing, and they're definitely getting some more depth, and you can understand their motivations a little better. Like it's funny because you could look at this show and think, well, it is, you know, it is just meant to be sort of a joke a minute, and it's meant to be very light, but they are still doing a good job of establishing these characters as interesting and valuable characters.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. And you know, typical Mariner, they don't put up with Q kind of, you know, attitude. Yeah. Like even he can influence them, right?
Yeah. I loved the whiny Q at the end where he's like, "Aw, Picard's no fun."
Oh, come on.
Yeah. That was funny.
For sure. Yeah.
Can't wait to see what they do. Right. 2 more episodes to go.
Yeah. Well, we'll see.
I wonder if we end with like just an episode, or if we end with some sort of, you know, Star Trek traditional, you know, tease for a bigger thing, if it'll just end cold. Or if it'll end with a where do we go next?
Did they do teases on the other series? Because they did the original series, obviously they didn't, because that wasn't how TV worked back then. But
no, and they didn't do it every season for TNG or the other shows, although it got
they had
more,
the Locutus crossover, right?
Yeah, it got more common in some of the other series, and then they've certainly done that since the sort of latest generation of shows. Disco has ended on cliffhangers, and Picard doesn't so much end on a cliffhanger as it ends on a sort of a new beginning or a new footstep forward.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's hard to say. I mean, you could make a case that it probably be better if they just sort of told a story, finished the story, and said come back next year, but who knows?
All right, let's move on to our watch list. What do you got? Who's Truth Seeker?
That's me. You? Sorry, I forgot to put my name next to it. Truth Seeker. So the trailer came out this week for a new series. It's coming to, we want to say Amazon Prime, called Truth Seekers, and it is Simon Pegg and Nick Frost. So,
oh, yes, right, yes.
Simon Pegg and Nick Frost have gotten to that point in my life where I will watch anything that they do.
Yeah.
Because I love them so very much. They are both really, really smart, really, really funny, and are not afraid to just go crazy on shows. Or movies or whatever else. So anytime they're going to get those two together, they have me. The latest show, which is coming on October 30th, is a... it looks like it's sort of a... bit of a mashup of genres. It's kind of like a ghost hunter-y kind of thing, where it looks like they're sending out Nick Frost goes out and does these like installations of, I'm guessing, internet services, but then he gets sort of wrapped up in this mystery of, you know, being able to speak to ghosts and sort of ghost hunting. It's a little bit strange. It's a little bit hard to follow. In typical them fashion, though, it looks very funny. Simon Pegg wearing a really hilarious toupee, and Nick Frost with his big crazy beard and just dropping one-liners like they're, you know, going out of style. And I saw the first trailer for this week. I must admit it hadn't been on my radar. I think at some point I knew that the two of them were working on a project, but it had completely slipped through. So when I saw this trailer this week, and especially the fact that it's coming out in like about a month, I was very excited. So we've got the link in the show notes. Give it a look. It is, I'm not sure it's going to be the best work they've ever done, but like I said, they have me. I'm in. I'm totally going to watch at least the first episode or two just to see how it is. And yeah, these guys, they're almost always worth at least giving a try to, because they are so funny.
What Star Trek thing have you got for us, Jaime, this week?
Yeah, you know, as the fall season is here, which means that Christmas shopping season is here. So if you were looking for something for that special Star Trek fan in your life, the Hallmark collection is actually interesting. It was like, oh, you know, we've got a musical tree topper of the original USS Enterprise to go along with that. They've got ornaments from the Mirror Mirror Universe collection of Sulu and Kirk and Uhura. But they've also got these, what they're calling itty bitties. So if you ever wanted to have the Borg Queen or Picard as Locutus, or a twofer of Captain Janeway and Seven of Nine from Voyager, you can get those, and you can have their adorable Charlie Brown-esque faces.
So which one are you giving to your significant other, Jaime?
to my significant other? That'd be a tricky one. But for myself, I'm like, man, I'm kind of digging the Locutus one.
Yeah.
And just have that in the background of your work conference calls.
Yeah, that could be fun.
Alrighty. Well, my pick is, as we talked about at the beginning of the show, is Brave New World, which I started watching. I think I'm two, maybe three episodes in. It's a bit. I wanted to ask you guys, because when we were in high school, we had to read Brave New World, as well as Animal Farm and Fahrenheit 451, and what was the Aldous Huxley one?
Isn't that Brave New World?
Or was Brave New World Aldous Huxley? I can't remember. There was another sci-fi one like this that we had to read, right? And I mean, the big focus for us when we were reading this was, oh my God, these, you know, children are all born, you know, not through natural birth. They're created in test tubes, and you become an alpha, beta, gamma, epsilon, and that would set your sort of cast you in life, right? So the alphas were obviously higher than the betas, and the, you know, betas higher than gammas, and gammas higher than epsilons. I mean, you may have that backwards. The epsilons are lowest ones, right? And in this show, you can sort of, you have these implants in your eyes that, like, sort of contacts, I guess, like Apple glasses, I think we might call them, where you look at somebody and you can see what their rating is, sort of thing, as long as you're on the network, as it were, right? And they're always popping these little happy pills to keep them all, you know, in a happy, joyful kind of mood, right? So anytime anybody gets anxious or has stress or whatever, there's one character, one of the main characters is always doling out these little happy pills that they take. But there's also another world of people in this world where, and they call it where the savages live. And the savages are those who are born through natural childbirth, and they live outside of this sort of perfect world. And the people in the perfect world go to vacation to these places like savage land, like amusement parks, where they get to look at how the savages live, and, you know, they have the world of monogamy and, you know, so on and so forth. But anyway, I don't remember any of that from reading the book in high school. And so I don't know if this is like, it's sort of a modern take on the idea, and they've just sort of thrown this in because, you know, I'm sure you know the setup. I've just said, you know, they have these people living in a perfect world. They go to the savage world. Something goes wrong, and they all kind of, like, you know, the two cultures mix, right? But do you guys remember, did you ever read the books when you were kids or teenagers? Or
I think I read the book maybe when I was in my late teens. I don't remember it very vividly. Yeah. It's pretty brief, as I recall. Not a very long book.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But do you remember the bit about the alphas and betas?
Yeah, the basic rating system. Yeah, the basic, right? Touchstones. Yes.
Yeah. So I kind of, I'm almost tempted. I don't know if I'm tempted to go back and read it again, but just to sort of get, because I don't think this is. It doesn't feel familiar. Like, it's a bit like the movie I, Robot. You know, where at the beginning there's a robot is accused of murdering somebody. Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. that doesn't have that. I don't know if that's a story that is like the iRobot books by Asimov are actually short stories and or collections of short stories. And I don't think there's like they Hollywoodized the whole thing with the story with Will Smith and mm-hmm. trying to figure out this, you know, who killed the gentleman that created the robot society mm-hmm. and Susan Calvin's in there and that kind of stuff. Right. He's a character that appears in a lot of she's sort of the Marie Curie or the, you know, kind of main character in robotics that appears in a lot of Asimov stories, right? But she's a character in the iRobot movie, right? And so it's kind of like a mix. I think they've taken some license with the story, but because I don't remember, I'd have to go. Maybe I'll go and do some research this week and see if it's the same. If they've played with the plot a bit, right? Maybe I should use my IMDb app to check it out. But it's an interesting show. It's so far it's you know nothing horrible about it. It's sort of you've got this perfect world and you've got this. You know, and of course, something happens in the perfect world that makes everybody kind of go,
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's an interesting story. I mean, like, I'm enjoying it, you know, like, and I do recommend that you guys take it in and check it out.
And the star is Alden Ehrenreich, who was the Han Solo, new Han Solo, right?
Is he?
He plays John the Savage.
Oh, him. Yes. You're right. Yeah. I wondered where I saw him from. He's the Savage dude.
And
now that you mention it,
yeah.
And the girl, I can't remember, I've seen her before, but
I think Jessica Brown Findlay, I'm just looking it up now. She was Downton Abbey, right?
Right. Yes. Oh, yes. She was the
Lady Sybil.
Yes, the younger sister, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I just the one thing I noticed about
She's the one that dies in Downton Abbey.
Oh, spoilers, dude, come on!
I just ruined it for everybody.
The one thing I noticed about it is that Grant Morrison was one of the writers. Grant Morrison is one of the most lauded and loved comic book creators of the last 30 years. Very, very, very influential. Very, very... you could see the Aldous Huxley in his writing. He's very much a mind-expanding comic writer. He doesn't write light work. He writes work that makes you think.
Wasn't Aldous Huxley the one that did a lot of drugs? And I think when he was sick and dying of cancer, he took even more?
That's a good question. I don't remember. I'm sure we could find that on online. I know he was, there was like a big scandal about him, right? That he might have plagiarized part of this. But yes. Oh, yeah. It says right here. Psychedelic drug use. Yes, indeed.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, good stuff. Wow. He apparently was quite into this stuff.
Yeah. Well, he's like LSD guy user, right? Like early LSD guy?
Yep. Yeah. Mescaline, LSD, yeah. All kinds of stuff. And yeah, it says he was onto some pretty hardcore LSD when he was suffering from cancer,
mm-hmm.
which is really how I'd like to experience things. It's a great Billy Connolly joke who says, I've never been into having sex with sheep or heroin, but when I find out I've got the cancer, that's where I'm going first.
Right. Which one?
Either way, I think both. He said, get that big fluffy one over by the fence. I'll get the needles.
Yeah, right. Uh-huh. Yeah, some of his jokes we can't repeat on this show.
Yeah, a lot of his jokes we can't repeat on this show.
All right, well, I guess that's it for another week. So, hey, Jaime, if people can get in touch with you, where do they find you?
I'm on Twitter as @DevOfTheHair.
Caught you by surprise, didn't I? and Jonathan, people want to get in touch with you?
I'm on Twitter and Instagram as @JPKNews.
All right, my name is Timitra, TIMMITRA on the Twitter machine is where you'll find me hanging out. So until next time, we'll see you in the future. Bye.
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 You've been listening to the Spockcast Podcast. If you want to find out more about the podcast or see the episode show notes, visit the Spockcast website at spockcast.com. You can get in touch with us on the website or follow us on Twitter at Spockcast. If you have feedback or questions, send us a tweet with the hashtag AskSpockcast. If you like the show, please consider recommending us to a friend, writing a review on iTunes, or pledging any amount at patreon.com/spockcast. You can find details on how to help us on our website, spockcast.com/sponsor us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in the future.
So I finally finished Umbrella Academy today.
Oh, really?
Today. Season two. If you have not watched it, totally you should watch it. I liked season one, but I loved season two. It's great. Highly, highly recommend. And particularly for you, Tim, because it is so Toronto. Like, there's so many scenes where you're like, I know where that is. There was a whole slew of scenes where I recognized exactly where they were.
Oh, in Toronto?
Yeah. And the last episode of The Boys that was on, again, also filmed here in Toronto, there was, a bunch of spots where I'm like, I know where that is.
Oh, really? Yeah.
The Boys just keeps getting better. I don't know. Are you up to date? You watched last week's episode?
Yes, of course I did. Yeah.
That show, that might be my favorite show on TV right now. It's really good.
Did you watch the
it's still on my to-do list to watch that. I wanted to catch up on Umbrella Academy, so I haven't watched anything else this week.
Yeah, I could just, like, I'm telling you that I don't want to spoil it, but the first episode is like right up your alley.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
The behind the scenes thing or the
Yes.
Or The Boys. Oh, behind the scenes. Yeah, I'll have to get into that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was actually it's been motivating me. I haven't reread The Boys since I read it originally when it first came out. I was thinking I should sit down and reread the books, because the books, it's funny because the show is pretty far over the top. Like, it's, you know, pretty graphically violent in language and the whole nine yards, but the book puts it to shame. Like, it is it's one of the most graphic, explicit, violent, sexual, vulgarity, all of it that I've ever seen in a comic book. It is way over the top.
I mean, so for me, the scene where Homelander's talking to the crowd.
Oh yeah,
right. And that was so amazing. Like, you know, and then and I don't want to give it away, but like, such like his what he really wanted to do was amazing, you know. Like, just that would have been so phenomenal if they just went, if they rolled with that. That would have been a PR nightmare.
Well, right? and the final scene from the last week's episode where there's a romantic scene between a couple of the superhero characters was done so well. Like, that's just so crazy.
Yeah,
like, what would happen if two people who were completely invulnerable decided they wanted to get it on? Like, oh, so good. So good. Like, throwing each other through buildings, and it was hilarious. I think, same thing. I really enjoyed season one, but season two really kicked it up a notch.
Yeah.
Jaime, are you watching that one weekly?
Yeah, I was looking to see if I was up to date, and it looks like they come out on Fridays. So yes, episode six comes out tomorrow. So I'm up to speed with everything here that I see on the Wikipedia, like, sort of recap.
Yeah, yeah, and it's short season two. It's only eight episodes, right?
But it was that's how many it was. Episode one or season one as well. So I guess that makes sense. Consistent. It's probably a pricey show to put together.
I wonder. I don't know. I mean,
special effects.
Yeah, I guess there is. You're probably right. It doesn't seem like they go way over the top on it, but I guess they do kind of casually drop in a lot of those, like when Starlight's eyes glow and all that stuff. That's all got to cost a couple of bucks too, eh? But apparently it's the highest rated show on Amazon Prime, like highest ever rated show on Amazon Prime is The Boys. I mean, it's got some pretty mainstream appeal, and it definitely taps into some of those audiences who are willing to give comic shows a bit more of a run now than they may have in the past.
True.
Although, again, some of the gore is surprising. The scene where the female, whatever it is they're calling her, she's simply called the female, where she's taking the hit jobs in the last episode, just like breaking people's necks, rips the guy's face off. Like, holy cow. Is that something you see on
Kimiko?
The
Yeah.
And it was so good to they brought the dog. They brought Terror, and Terror is a huge part of the comic book. I read an interview this week with the showrunner. It was on EW, Entertainment Weekly's site, where they were saying, you know, hey, it's so great you finally got the dog on the show. And he's like, yeah, we specifically hired that dog because it was supposed to be able to, like, have sex with stuffed animals on command. And they wanted to do a scene, because that was kind of the joke from the comics, is that Butcher teaches his dog how to have sex on command.
Well, do you want spoilers?
Well, now we'll say spoilers. If you haven't seen this,
well,
dive in.
Yeah. Spoilers for the, well, this is a spoiler for the after what's it called, the behind the scenes thing that I was telling you about.
Yeah, the boys behind the scenes or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. So one of the actors said a little spoiler for about that is that the dog would not do what the dog is supposed to do to the stuffed animal.
Yes. So yeah, they said they specifically got this one dog because it had been trained how to do this bulldog.
Yes.
And then they said not only would it not do that on command for the shoot, so they had to sort of basically there's one scene at the end where, you know, he throws him a doll of what's the superhero Superman stand-in Homelander. He throws him a Homelander doll and says, you know, hey, have your way with this thing. But he was supposed to actually do it, and they couldn't get him to do it. But apparently he wouldn't even walk with the actor. So at one point he's supposed to be walking with Butcher down the street. And so if you look at that scene, all you see is a pair of legs, because the only person that could walk the dog was the handler. So they got him into a pair of pants that matched what the outfit was for Butcher and then put him on. So But the guy basically said, like, I'm out. No more working with animals. Like, it's just such a pain in the butt. But it's a shame, because the comic book, the way they use that dog is hilarious at times. But again, stuff you could do in a comic that you can't do. It's exactly what Jaime's been saying about Lower Decks, right? All the things you can do in a cartoon, you can't do on a live action show, because they would cost you a fortune. I don't think they're going to CG a bulldog having its way with a Homelander doll.
Right.
That might be misspent money, I think. Jeff Bezos will call you. What are you spending my money on? Talk to you next week, guys.
Okay, talk to you later.
See ya.
Bye.
How do we end this meeting? Here we go. There's the button. Bye.